All right.
And when he attacked you, especially for young people to understand your thoughts at the time, what went through your mind?
Is that the problem was him. I wasn't the problem. He was trying to get rid of us so that he could act as though that the problem was us. Problem is never the person that's being beat, all right? It's the person that doesn't have a reason to beat people and beats people, who hates people and have no reason for it, right? We've done nothing. What have we done to America that they should hate us so, right? We haven't done it to America. America's, but you can state 30 or 40 things very quickly about what American democracy, quote unquote, has done to us. And we were just trying to live for the faith, huh? Died in every war, all right? And yet anybody who came here 10 minutes later was accepted.
Civil rights legend C.T. Vivian. I interviewed him in 2015 in Selma, Alabama. Reverend Vivian died on Friday at the age of 95, his funeral scheduled for Thursday at Providence Baptist Church in Atlanta. Out of respect for Reverend Vivian, the Lewis family says it'll wait till after his services to announce their plans for Congressmember Lewis's memorial. To see the full interviews, democracynow.org, I'm Amy Goodman.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Clinton Street Theater's virtual screening of The Last Tree. The Last Tree follows a British boy of Nigerian descent who becomes reunited with his biological mother. The film explores his struggle with the unfamiliar culture and values while learning what it means to be a young black man in London. Again, that's the Clinton Street Theater's virtual screening of The Last Tree. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, federal officers continue to use violent tactics against demonstrators in Portland. More than half of COVID-19 deaths in Oregon have been linked to senior living or group housing settings. And early results suggest that a coronavirus vaccine made by Oxford induces an immune response. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 20th, 2020. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Protests against police brutality and systemic racism continued in Portland over the weekend. On Friday, federal officers used tear gas and other crowd dispersal munitions on protesters outside the Multnomah County Justice Center, after once again declaring an unlawful assembly. On Saturday night, a Navy veteran was beaten by federal officers in downtown Portland. Nearby demonstrators captured video of the assault, which has been circulating on social media. The footage shows Chris David being struck repeatedly by federal law enforcement officers with batons outside the federal courthouse building in downtown Portland. David was taken to the hospital with a fractured hand that will require surgery. David said, quote, "They are playing me up as an Iron Man and a Superman. I'm a 53-year-old overweight man on blood thinners, and I have a lot of physical damage from the military, so I'm not made of steel at all. They could have killed me last night." David added that he is most disturbed by the lack of accountability by police. He says in the military there are consequences for your actions, and although the police are now acting like the military, he sees little consequences for their actions. Also on Saturday, federal officers launched flashbangs at an organization of mothers that had formed a wall of moms to protect demonstrators. Later in the night, officers used tear gas and crowd control munitions to disperse protesters. Sunday marked the 53rd consecutive day of protests in Portland since the murder of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Federal officers used tear gas multiple times throughout Sunday night. Videos shared on social media over the weekend also show federal agents detaining people without explanation and driving off in unmarked vehicles. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum filed a lawsuit accusing the agents of violating the civil rights of residents by using unlawful tactics. Rosenblum filed lawsuits in federal court seeking a restraining order barring the Department of Homeland Security and other federal law enforcement agencies from seizing and detaining protesters in Portland without probable cause. She also announced that the Oregon Department of Justice and the Multnomah County District Attorney would open a criminal investigation into the July 11th injury of Donovan LaBella, who was shot in the face with a munition by a U.S. Marshals Service officer. Protests calling out police brutality and systemic racism have been ongoing since the murder of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis, Minnesota in May. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Across the country today, workers are striking for Black lives. Striking workers span industries from fast food restaurants to healthcare and hospitals. Some plan to walk off at noon for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, the length of time Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin is widely believed to have had his knee on George Floyd's neck. Penny Brooks, a patient care coordinator at University of Washington Medicine, believes she's experienced racism in her job. She says she had to jump through hoops her white coworkers didn't to work from home during this pandemic.
I had to write a letter to justify my condition, what I can do from home. When you have all the white people in my job to the whole HR working from home. So I'm facing systemic racism right now as of today.
The strikes are being coordinated by the Service Employees International Union, American Federation of Teachers, and other unions and organizations. Brooks is a member of SEIU Local 925. The University of Washington Medicine did not respond to a request for comment by deadline. Daryl Johnson is a caregiver in Tacoma with SEIU 775. He says he's been racially profiled by police multiple times. He notes the issue of racial justice is linked to economic justice in the workplace.
It's intertwined. It's pretty much the same thing. Because you can't have one without the other. You can't have racial justice, social justice without it all combining.
Johnson says this moment feels different, with protests happening around the world. Even within his union, he says they are having teach-ins on racial justice.
I never sat around and did nothing like that. That's a change, too, with everybody sitting at the table and everybody's getting together and come together to help make a change, to help make a difference.
Brooks still is trying to make a change in her workplace. She's fighting to get more equity for her and her Black colleagues.
I'm hoping something come out of it. I don't know if I still have my job, but at the end, I don't mind. If it's going to make a change within the organization, I would be happy.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
On Sunday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 436 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19, bringing the state total to 14,579 cases. Multnomah County had the highest number of new cases on Sunday, with 123 coronavirus cases. Oregon health officials also announced 3 more deaths, raising the state's death total to 260. On Monday morning, Dr. Jennifer Vines, the health officer for Multnomah County, held a news conference to give updates on the status of COVID-19 in the area. Vines talked about regional disease trends, concerns about an increasing strain on coronavirus testing, and water safety risks during hot weather. Vines said Oregon's hospital capacity is fine for now, but cases are increasing among younger people because they are meeting in groups. According to a weekly data report from state health officials, more than half of coronavirus deaths in Oregon have been linked to senior living or group housing settings. The Oregon Health Authority is tracking active outbreaks in at least 30 care facilities, while outbreaks at another 38 have been resolved. Although more research is still needed, early results suggest that Oxford's COVID-19 vaccine appears safe and induces immune response. Dr. Mike Ryan, the executive director of the World Health Organization Health Emergencies Program, said, quote, "This is a positive result. But again, there's a long way to go. These are phase one studies. We now need to move into larger scale real world trials, but it is good to see more data and more products moving into this very important phase of vaccine discovery. According to the World Health Organization, there are 23 COVID-19 vaccines currently in clinical trial around the world. Since March, many states have done a good job in keeping teens from entering juvenile detention centers. But getting teens already in custody released is an area still lagging. Mike Moen has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Positive trends concerning populations at youth detention centers in the U.S. have hit a snag, according to a new report. However, long-term efforts to keep teens out of these facilities still offer hope, including in Minnesota. When the pandemic started, the Annie E. Casey Foundation says there was a steep drop in admission rates at certain youth detention facilities. But its new analysis found a population uptick in May. Nate Bayless, head of the foundation's Juvenile Justice Strategy Group, says while the front door of juvenile detention has narrowed, systems have struggled to get kids out.
While the overall drop in admissions was over 50%, the drop in the population was down only 32%. That tells us that there are obstacles that systems are facing in getting kids out of detention, even as they're being successful in keeping kids out of detention.
Bayless says it means many teens are still living in pretrial confinement, possibly exposing them to COVID-19. He says Black teens are disproportionately affected. In Ramsey County, officials say their current detention population is mostly African American, and the length of stay now averages a month, which is longer than usual. Overall, the county has reduced juvenile detention admissions by 75% since 2005, and it says it has found success in placing kids in more productive settings after sentencing. That's because Ramsey County is working with the foundation on its Deep End program, which tries to reduce reliance on non-home placement. Michelle Finstad with the county's juvenile division says prior to the effort, they had a significant number of youth, especially children of color, in non-home placement. But there's been a nearly 60% drop in deep end placement since 2014. That includes fewer minorities placed in long-term confinement. Finstad credits the assistance of community groups in shifting kids toward more productive settings after they're sentenced.
Since 2015, we have tripled the number of community-based services that we provide. We've also worked really hard to develop more family engagement. We have trained our staff on family-engaged case planning, moving away from a more traditional model of supervision.
Finstad says they also keep an eye on safety through risk assessments. She adds they're still working on reducing racial gaps for both the short term and long term. As for kids being held longer during the pandemic, foundation officials say a pandemic-induced limit on court hearings might be playing a role. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
The average-sized school district in the U.S. could pay as much as $1.8 million to reopen all of its school buildings under the new safety guidelines established by health and education experts. Now teachers are calling on Congress to fund the safe reopening of schools. Eric Galatis has more on the story with the Public News Service.
As school districts scramble to reopen in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, educators in Colorado and across the nation say they'll need more financial support from the federal government to open safely. School districts will need more teachers, substitutes, and custodians, more buses for social distancing, and personal protection equipment. Denver area high school teacher Emily Mullenberg says teachers are eager to see their kids again, but many are also terrified.
We don't know if we're going to have to purchase our own hand sanitizer. What are kids going to be responsible for? Does that mean that I should also go buy my own box of disposable masks just in case one of my students shows up without one?
New guidelines released by the American Federation of Teachers call for holding back on reopening schools in districts until the number of new COVID-19 cases drop for at least 2 consecutive weeks. The union is also calling for ramping up the capacity to test, trace, and isolate each new case. President Donald Trump has threatened to withhold funding unless schools reopen and points to Germany, Denmark, and other countries where schools have reopened without problems. Mullenberg notes that, unlike in the U.S., people in countries where schools have reopened are following all health expert recommendations. All students wear masks, and there's enough funding for additional staff, protective gear, and making sure classrooms are thoroughly cleaned.
Because they were able to get a handle on this virus so much earlier, not only did they send their kids back to school, but Denmark had like 11 new cases. cases this week. Well, we had 11 new cases on my block.
It's projected to cost nearly $2 million for the average size school district to reopen all of its school buildings under the new safety guidelines, according to analysis by leading education associations. Muhlenberg says she hopes Congress will step up with the same kind of support given to banks and big corporations during the economic downturn, because she says the economy will take a lot longer to recover if parents have to stay home with their kids. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. Then at 6, Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear skies with a low of 67 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 88 degrees. Today in history, in 1969, American astronaut Neil Armstrong becomes the first person to walk on the surface of the moon. The quote of the day is from Neil Armstrong, who said, quote, "I think we're going to the moon because it's in the nature of human being to face challenges." Civil rights icon and Georgia Congressman John Lewis passed away on Friday. After fighting for civil rights, including voting rights, his whole career, Jim Clyburn and other House Democrats want to honor Lewis by passing into law voting rights legislation. With more on the story, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
The movement lost an icon, and I lost a personal friend.
House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn remembers and honors his longtime friend and civil rights icon, the late Georgia Congressman John Lewis, who passed away on Friday at age 80 from pancreatic cancer.
John was one of those people who internalized nonviolence. Many of us practice it, but John lived it.
Also Friday, the Reverend C.T. Vivian died at 95. He was also a leader in the civil rights movement and was once described by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as, quote, the greatest preacher to ever live, unquote. Lewis, who endured police brutality fighting for voting rights in the 60s, continued his civil rights work during his 27 years in Congress. Here he is last year introducing House Democrats' Democracy Reform Bill, H.R. 1.
I said on many occasions that the vote is the most powerful nonviolent instrument of transformation we have in our democracy, we have in a democratic society. And at the foundation of our system, it must be strengthened and preserved.
Yesterday, Clyburn was joined by Representatives Karen Bass and Ayanna Pressley, among others, in calling for the swift passage of voting rights legislation to honor the Georgia congressman. H.R. 4, the Voting Rights Advancement Act, passed the House last year, but the Republican-controlled Senate has ignored it. It would restore key voting protections that the Supreme Court struck down in 2013. Lawyer Max Feldman at the Brennan Center for Justice says the ruling opened the door for voter suppression.
I'm talking about laws like strict voter ID laws, cutbacks to early voting, new obstacles to voter registration, things like that that make it more difficult to get on the voter rolls, stay on the voter rolls, and cast an effective ballot.
Until the 2013 decision, states with histories of voter discrimination had to get approval from the Justice Department before making any changes related to voting. But not anymore, explains Anna Dennis from Common Cause Georgia.
We lost measures that allowed for having more voting units, more poll workers, more oversight. We lost that. It's what we needed to make sure that we actually had fair, equitable elections.
Since April, the Supreme Court has issued four decisions making it harder for some people to vote. In Florida, people with past felony convictions and any unpaid court fees can't vote in their August primary, though there could be a ruling to change that before November. The other three cases in Texas, Alabama, and Wisconsin rejected the expansion of mail-in voting during the COVID-19 pandemic. In a Fox News interview, President Trump falsely claimed vote-by-mail could, quote, rig, unquote, the November election, refusing to say whether he'll accept the results. And again, he downplayed the severity of the current coronavirus crisis. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Tribal leaders say broken promises have led to severe COVID-19 impacts on tribes. And First Nations in Quebec mark the 30-year anniversary of a standoff and call for their land back. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribal leaders and tribal health experts say federal broken promises to tribes have created a perfect storm in Indian country as tribes fight COVID-19. They say failures in treaty and trust responsibilities have led to disproportionate harmful impacts of COVID-19 on Native people. A 6-member panel testified virtually Friday before the United States Commission on Civil Rights. They say lack of broadband makes telehealth nearly impossible. Social distancing is hard due to overcrowded housing. Lack of modern infrastructure such as indoor plumbing creates hygiene challenges, and the severely underfunded Indian Health Service is compounded by COVID-19. Mohegan Chief and Secretary of the United South and Eastern Tribes, Lynn Malherbe.
The federal government's historic and ongoing neglect of its obligations to tribal nations is being brought into sharper focus by the COVID-19 public health emergency. Decades of broken promises, underfunding, and inaction have left Indian country severely under-resourced and at extreme risk during this crisis. Our existing systems of service delivery and infrastructure are experiencing greater stress than those of other units of government as we seek to maintain essential services and depend on our commitments while responding to COVID-19.
Tribal leaders say the federal government has also failed in delivering COVID-19 relief aid. They say emergency funding has been delayed and federal agencies tasked with disbursement do not know how to work with tribes. Tribal leaders are calling for systemic change and for the federal government to honor its treaty and trust responsibilities. The Presidential Task Force examining missing and murdered American Indian and Alaska Native people will not be meeting in person due to COVID-19. Instead, 12 tribal consultations will be held virtually. The sessions are regionally based by Bureau of Indian Affairs areas, with the first consultation scheduled in August. The task force is expected to present a progress report to the president in November and a final report by November 2021. Recently, First Nations in Quebec marked the 13th anniversary of the OCA crisis. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, some say the issues remain unresolved decades later.
World attention was riveted 3 decades ago on the small town of Oka, about 30 miles northwest of Montreal. At the time, Quebec provincial police moved in on a barricade set up by Mohawks who were protesting against the planned expansion of a golf course on what they claimed was ancestral land. One police officer was killed, and what came after was a 78-day standoff between Mohawks, the police, and the Canadian military. A slow-moving convoy of vehicles with people waving flags and sounding horns marked the anniversary. Ellen Gabriel is a Mohawk activist and spokeswoman for the people of the Longhouse in Ganasatagi.
But today is marking the peaceful barricade that we had on July 11th. Our basic human rights were violated by the Sûreté du Québec, by the Canadian Army, and condoned by the governments of Canada and Quebec. And to say once again to Canada and all the colonizers that this land belongs to the people of the Ganyakahaga Nation.
Gabriel says her people want their land back as part of reconciliation. She adds that First Nations must also be part of the decision-making process on their land, and that's reconciliation, one that also respects Indigenous laws. Others say today First Nations face the same lack of respect, denial of rights, and infringement on land that they faced 30 years ago. The 78-day siege ended when the golf course development was cancelled, but the underlying land dispute remains unresolved. The government says it must be acknowledged that progress in relations has been unequal, halting, and often far too slow. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A Canadian company recycles minerals from old lithium-ion batteries. There's opportunity to reuse those materials and make them as good as new. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. As electric vehicles become more mainstream, the demand for lithium-ion car batteries is growing. But to increase production, the industry needs more lithium, cobalt, and nickel. One possible source is batteries that are no longer in use.
It's a bit of a waste to just have batteries sitting in a landfill, and there's opportunity there to reuse those materials, make them good as new.
That's Canal Falfer of Li-Cycle. The company uses a two-step process to recover more than 80% of the materials in old lithium-ion batteries.
We take the batteries and shred them, and then phase two of the process is then to take that mixed material and separate each of the elements through chemical processing.
The approach generates less carbon pollution than mining those minerals from the ground. And it solves another problem the booming industry is grappling with: how to safely and sustainably dispose of spent batteries. Li-Cycle has a demonstration plant in Canada, and Falfer says it's building a new facility in Rochester, New York. Last December, the company shipped its first commercial load of recycled battery material to a customer, a critical milestone on the road to addressing this global challenge. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Opponents of new oil and gas leases presented 33,000 public protests to lawmakers in 2019 in support of methane emission limits. Roz Brown has more on the story with the Public News Service.
A federal judge is requiring the Bureau of Land Management to reinstate a rule that limits methane emissions from oil and gas drilling. Residents of western states who fought for the rule are praising the decision and also assuming it will be appealed. The Trump administration rolled back the 2016 methane reduction rule, but the judge's decision to reinstate it allows 90 days for further litigation. New Mexico rancher Don Schreiber says leaks, vents, and flares are not only dangerous to public health, but a financial loss for extraction companies.
There is no rhyme or reason as to why they would take a rule that is so beneficial, including to the oil companies, that they would attack it.
In recent weeks, the courts have also blocked the Keystone XL and Dakota Access oil pipelines for inadequate environmental reviews. In rolling back the methane rule, the BLM argued it was burdensome for industry and would prevent job creation. The judge called that justification wholly inadequate. Indigenous communities are disproportionately affected by the environmental hazards of oil and gas extraction. Carol Davis with a nonprofit Diné Care says thousands of Native Americans live within a half mile of oil and gas drilling sites, and limiting methane emissions could improve their health.
Heart disease, respiratory issues, nausea, headaches, migraines, and guessing from what I experience personally, people's health has to definitely improve significantly if they're prohibiting waste.
At his ranch, Schreiber is surrounded by 122 oil and gas wells. He says in addition to addressing human health, the Obama-era rule was meant to reduce climate change impacts from methane emissions.
It was really devastating to see it come under attack when you're a frontline community like my family is, and like my neighbors and so many rural people across the West, particularly indigenous people.
In finding revocation of the methane rule illegal, the judge said the Trump administration systematically ignored the basics of rulemaking and steamrolled over federal laws to advance certain special interests. For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Monday, July 20th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bulkey, Eric Tegedoff, Roz Brown, Eric Galatis, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU at 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show,
covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Stage and Studio. Host Mae Roberts presents an excerpt of The Journey of Lady Buddha, a personal and historical exploration of cultural conflicts in spirituality. Then at 11:30, Art Focus host Joseph Galavan interviews three people about thousands of dollars of grants available to artists during the time of the COVID-19 pandemic and ongoing Black Lives Matter protests. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, dozens of groups and state and local officials have just sent an open letter to Congress. The $150 billion designated for state, local, and tribal governments as relief from the COVID-19 crisis is nowhere near what those governments will need. And not just that, but forcing them to cut budgets just as they need to be spending more is going to drive a cycle that only hurts more those already hurting. We'll talk about what could be done instead with Naomi Walker, director of the Economic Analysis and Research Network, working out of the Economic Policy Institute, who spearheaded the letter. Also on the show, last October, USA Today ran a story headlined, "With raging fires, high winds, and blackouts, California is living a disaster movie. Is this the new normal?" Little did they know. The distress and dystopia and the fear of media's normalization of it led us to questions then that we hold on to today. What could journalism be doing, not just to give context to factors behind the crisis, but to illuminate different ways forward that are so obviously called for? We talked last November with Johanna Bozua, co-manager of the Climate and Energy Program at the Democracy Collaborative. We'll hear part of that conversation today. That's coming up, but first, a quick look back at some recent press. You may have heard CNN and others using terms like propaganda, meltdown, and rant to describe Donald Trump's propagandistic ranting meltdowns, also known as press briefings. That's a welcome development. It took them long enough to get there and seemed to require direct attacks on them personally, but we'll take it. What we should not take, though, is a press corps prepared to issue bold and incisive criticism of a raging sociopath, but when it comes to serious alternatives, actual systemic change, well, let's not get carried away. Workers devastated by the loss of their job and their health care at once? That's just terrible. Medicare for all? That's pretty radical. Maybe an op-ed. Nurses, farm workers, and meat packers suffering on the front line? Deeply deserving of attention and sympathy. A livable, enforceable minimum wage that keeps pace with productivity? Well, you know, there are some very smart people who think that's a bad idea. Restructuring the economy so disasters like COVID don't further immiserate those already struggling while scoring billionaires still more billions? What are you, a socialist? Criticism of Trump, no matter how smart or funny, is no substitute for the radical undoing of the systems that made his presidency possible, the levers he was and is able to pull. That work involves listening to the people who are virtually never on the guest list and exploring ideas corporate media find unfit to print. On the pandemic itself, there's a lot of talk these days about the coronavirus peak. As coronavirus cases near 2 million, countries try to look beyond peak, was a New York Times headline. Other outlets are speculating about when each state will peak in fatalities from the pandemic. The idea of a peak gives the comforting impression that there's a corner to be turned and then life can get back to some kind of normal. The worst is over, as New York Governor Andrew Cuomo was recently quoted in the Times. As Jim Narikis writes for FAIR.org, predictions of a peak are based on computer modeling, particularly from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. Their model produces graphs that tend to suggest a rapid rise and fall in COVID-19 deaths. You can see these graphs on FAIR.org. We certainly hope to see the toll of the coronavirus trailing away dramatically, but it may also be another instance in which media are misleading by paying more attention to computer simulations than to real-world examples. Take Italy, the Western country with the earliest major COVID-19 outbreak. When you look at new cases per day, they've been arriving at a fairly consistent rate of about 3,000 to 6,000 a day for a month now. And this, in turn, has led to a quite steady level of active cases of infection, which helps explain why the number of deaths per day in Italy is falling very gradually, if at all. You see similar plateaus in other Western countries that had early major outbreaks, like Spain and France. And the same pattern can be seen in California, the first and one of the best controlled outbreaks in the U.S. It's possible that these outbreaks will soon take a turn for the better, and new cases and deaths will indeed fall off sharply. But it's also possible that the response to the coronavirus's lethality and asymptomatic infectiousness, that response being drastic physical separation necessary to prevent a quickly mounting death toll, that means that COVID-19 might not be a normal disease with a steep arrival curve and an equally sudden departure. In other words, there may be no peak, per se. People should absolutely be thinking about how elements of normal life can be resumed most safely if the coronavirus ebbs away. But we also need to think about what we'll do if physical separation is something that needs to be sustained not for weeks, but for months, or even until a vaccine is available. How do we keep people fed and housed and cared for if much of the economy isn't functioning? And how do we maintain the economy such that it can be revived when that's safe to do? It's far better to have plans to answer those questions than to cross our fingers and hope we don't have to. Finally, even before the coronavirus made it glaringly obvious, it was clear that internet access is critical to daily living, which is why many people think it should be a public service, like water or electricity. Now, imagine trying to access telehealth services or file for unemployment or do schoolwork remotely without reliable access. No one should have to. But as the group Free Press reminds us, the cost of broadband is so high and the ISP's policies are so discriminatory that even before the pandemic cost millions of people their paycheck, more than one-fifth of households in the country didn't have home internet. Just 56% of households making less than $20,000 a year had home broadband, with low-income Black and Hispanic households even less likely to have it than their low-income white counterparts. It's not enough to have access, a wire running to your house, without affordability. Free Press is encouraging folks to send a message to Congress that the next stimulus package must provide necessary resources to make sure people can connect and stay connected to broadband and phone services during the pandemic and the economic crisis that comes with it. You can find a letter you can sign on to if you choose at freepress.net. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The absence of competent, much less compassionate, federal coordination and guidance through the economic shock of the COVID-19 crisis is becoming clear. State and local governments are struggling with the combination of new demands and a steep drop in revenue. And remember, unlike the feds, most states have to balance their budgets. That's why more than 180 organizations and state and local elected officials sent an open letter to members of Congress calling for $500 billion in relief for state, local, territorial, and tribal governments, along with other transformative investments. We're joined now by Naomi Walker, Director of the Economic Analysis and Research Network, a network of state policy research and advocacy groups coordinated by the Economic Policy Institute, who spearheaded this open letter. She joins us by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Naomi Walker.
Thanks so much, Janine. Glad to be here.
Well, it's not just the raw fact that the $150 billion that the CARES Act designated for state and local governments is not enough. This open letter underscores that that insufficiency of resources drives decisions that drive decisions that end up pushing real recovery further out of sight. Is that so?
That's exactly right. You know, with states and localities facing these shortfalls, and as you mentioned, they're not able to do deficit spending like the federal government can and should. And so they resort to cutting budgets and cutting budgets for programs that are really important, particularly in the midst of a pandemic and economic crisis. Ohio, for instance, just announced that they're going to do 20% across the board budget cut, or at least that's what the governor has proposed. And that has real implications for people and how quickly we can get the economy back on track after the crisis is over.
So, you know, these budget cuts clearly are going to fall. We know who they fall on. When someone says austerity, we know who gets hurt by that. And it's the people who are already hurting most now.
Exactly. The most vulnerable workers, workers in low-wage jobs, communities of color, women, you know, a lot of the groups that we see negatively impacted by a lot of the policies in place will be certainly bear the brunt of the impact of these budget cuts.
Well, beyond the $500 billion, the letter, again, signed by a range of groups, Atlanta Jobs with Justice, to the Center for Disability Rights, to Citizen Action Illinois, it urges Congress to adopt a transformative approach to protecting workers and businesses. What does that mean, a transformative approach?
I think that this is really an opportunity to think bigger and think in a bolder way than we have before about what it's going to take, not just to fill the gaps in our infrastructure that this crisis is so clearly laid bare, but also to think beyond about what we want our economy to look like, what we want our safety net to look like going forward so that, you know, there and able to support an economy that works for everybody, not just the very richest among us. And so, you know, one of the approaches that EPI is calling for, along with a lot of other groups, is that the U.S. should be considering some type of payroll guarantee program, just like United Kingdom, Denmark, and the Netherlands have implemented. And that would allow workers to stay attached to their jobs. The national government in those models pay up to 90% of all payroll costs for employers that are impacted by the shutdown. And that really helps create an economic deep freeze that allows everybody just hold tight, you know, it holds workers and businesses as harmless as possible while the economy shuts down and people stay home to help stave off the worst of the pandemic.
Yeah, it's possible to have a pause and not to have a crash.
Right.
But framing matters so much here. Keeping ideas like a protected pause off the page or in the margin, I think, is legitimizing these fake and unnecessary choices that are lethal, you know, that are killing people. But there's a sense that, oh, well, we have to make a trade-off, and we don't have to make that trade-off. We can do something else.
Yeah, there are other ways. You're exactly right. It's a false choice that's being set up, and the federal government has the resources that it could really throw down right now and stave off the economic pain that people are already feeling, and if more significant measures aren't taken very soon, you know, are going to be feeling for a very long time.
Yeah, pain and, of course, insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's going to come next? But if you mention other countries, other models, you mentioned the UK, Denmark, and Netherlands, it's like, avert your eyes, you know. We can't do that here because it's not American something-something freedom.
Well, we've seen what the American system has gotten us, and it's left people vulnerable and exposed, and it's time to look for other models.
Well, what are some of the other things that this letter is encouraging Congress to do?
So we think that one of the things that this pandemic has shown us, just like the Great Recession and the state fiscal crisis before that in 2000 has shown us, is that our nation's unemployment insurance system is really not prepared for a crisis of this magnitude. And we think that, well, Congress took really unprecedented measures to expand unemployment insurance in a way we've just never seen before, and that's fantastic. There's more that needs to be done. And so we want to make sure that the benefits that were included in the CARES Act continue for as long as economic conditions warrant. The CARES Act set kind of arbitrary guidelines for when some of this aid would end. Some of the new expansions in the unemployment insurance system end at the end of July. Who knows where we're going to be at the end of July? And so instead of tying it to random dates, we think it really needs to be tied to continuing as long as we're in this economic downturn. We also know that unemployment insurance, even though it's vastly expanded who is eligible for the pandemic unemployment assistance, there are still some workers that are going to fall through the cracks, and it's not small numbers. These are significant numbers of workers. And so immigrant workers who were left out of these expansions and new labor market entrants, like college students or folks just coming out of college or folks coming out of the criminal justice system who don't have a work history are not able to get this new unemployment insurance right now, and we think that needs to be fixed. And then the last thing is, you know, there's been a ton of media reports talking about how long people are waiting on hold trying to get through to their state unemployment insurance offices. And while there's been some money for administrative aid included in some of the federal bills, we think that it needs $30 to $40 billion more dollars to make sure that those systems can meet the demand.
There are other things about, and you don't have to go through them all, but the direct cash payment that a lot of folks looked again to other countries and said, you know, they're getting covered for a long time. We're getting a one-time check,
right?
You know, which is going to be late because Donald Trump needs to put his name on it.
Exactly.
But back in reality, you think more needs to be done in terms of direct cash payments.
Yeah, for sure. $1,200 one time, just not enough. We need to look at that amount on a monthly basis for the remainder of this crisis. You know, the cash payment was also really restrictive about who's eligible to receive the payment and limited it to folks who have filed tax returns or are citizens. And we think that it should be available to anybody who is making under the income threshold, regardless of their tax filing or immigration status.
And we know, of course, that folks contribute to the economy.
Right.
We know that that money will go directly into goods and services, which is presumably what you want to happen.
Exactly. It's not like the folks who would be getting this money are like hoarding this away or throwing it under their mattresses. These are folks who need this money. They need to spend it on rent and groceries and health care. It will be a big boost to the economy to get money into folks' hands.
And then there are points again about personal protective equipment and testing and treatment for frontline workers and things to do with worker protections in general.
You know, again, we've seen so many stories and heard from so many workers who completely lack the kind of protective equipment that they need. We also know that there's not enough money for testing and treatment. We want to make sure that, you know, anybody that gets tested or treated for coronavirus, those expenses should be picked up by the federal government. And as the CDC and the Trump administration talk about getting people back to work in the next few weeks, which is completely misguided, we need to make sure that we're talking about protective equipment and protective gear for everybody, not just the essential frontline workers.
Well, with Trump doing his Trump thing, there is a lot of focus on state and local governments. But, you know, and then we see the White House directing state relief in these hyper-partisan ways, and states, it feels like, scrabbling among themselves for resources. I mean, other governments are going to do what they can, but there really is no substitute for federal-level coordination on something like this, is there?
Absolutely. This is a clear case of where the federal government has an incredibly vital role to play. And the fact is, the Trump administration has really fallen down on the job, not unexpectedly, but still it's tragic to see the consequences of this failure to act and this failure to lead in this moment. And, you know, the nation's governors are doing a tremendous job in many cases trying to make sure that their states equipment that it needs, that they get the resources it needs. But even with that tremendous leadership that we're seeing come out of many governors, it's just not a substitute for federal action.
Well, let me just ask you finally, has there been response, or what has been the response to the letter? And is there a follow-up plan? What comes next?
I think what's next is we have to continue to put as much pressure as possible on Congress to allocate this $500 billion. There's incredible alignment among the folks who work at the state and local levels. We're hearing the call for $500 billion coming out of the governors, the counties, the League of Cities, you know, and all the advocacy groups that have signed on to this letter. And so, you know, it's clear what needs to be done. And the question is there going to be enough consensus in Congress to make it happen? What we've been hearing up until now, and the House leadership is pushing for as much aid as possible, but what we're hearing so far is that the numbers being discussed for state and local aid are really still not up to the task of what needs to be done. And so there's a tremendous amount of work. So I hope that people are reaching out to the congressional delegations and urging them to move this money to the states and localities as quickly as possible.
We've been speaking with Naomi Walker, director of the Economic Analysis and Research Network, EARN, coordinated by the Economic Policy Institute. They're online at epi.org. Naomi Walker, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much, Janine. It was great to be here.
Last fall, people were using words like unlivable to describe parts of California, where wildfires and power outages were driving new kinds of crisis and exacerbating existing ones. Climate disruption, of course, was at the heart of it, but also a private utility system that isn't and hasn't been incentivized to address it. Johanna Bozua, co-manager of the Climate and Energy Program at the Democracy Collaborative, talked with Counterspin in early November. I asked first about the power outages planned by the utility company Pacific Gas and Electric because they were concerned that power lines might trigger wildfires in high winds, as had in fact happened in 2018, killing 85 people. But can shutting off power when conditions could spark fires, which due to climate disruption is going to be an awful lot of times, seriously serve as Plan A?
There's a lot of history that's here in terms of PG&E not investing in its grid for so many years and really putting shareholder profits ahead of the infrastructure that we now have, which has created this concept of the new normal. But it also doesn't have to be. I mean, having these power shutoffs come on again and again, Governor Newsom has even said these are incredibly not surgical. They are doing blanket shutoffs because they're afraid of liability, but they're also not providing the infrastructure that communities need to actually make it through these. So their phone lines are off. You can't get onto their website, and there's only a generator station for every county. And so that's just showing that this is not just them taking precautions. This is them severely mismanaging a situation in which people are losing their power and losing access to maybe life-sustaining medical apparatuses as well.
Well, and you point to history. They aren't just any utility that is being forced to deal with climate disruption. There's more that we should know about the role they've played vis-a-vis climate change, isn't there?
Oh, yes, definitely. And the Energy and Policy Institute had a really important expose. We hear a lot about Exxon new and Shell new on the news, but utilities new too. They were part and parcel to the climate disinformation campaigns that have happened in the past and have sowed disinformation. And PG&E was a part of that as well. So PG&E is not a good actor in this situation. They are the ones that were able to make money off of fossil fuels for so many years and stopping action on climate change for years as well. And now they are paying the price with their own infrastructure that they failed to invest in so that it was ready for the new climate that they had in part given us.
Well, alternatives are not just possible. They are, as you write, waiting. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the idea of public utilities.
Yeah, absolutely. So I advocate that PG&E should be transitioned into public ownership because it can eliminate some of those warped incentives that are associated with monopoly investor-owned utilities that operate our energy system. And we can move towards a situation in which a public good is provided by a public service. So by moving to a public institution, we are going to have hopefully a more accountable utility whose shareholders and stockholders are us. It is the people who are living in California and not the shareholders who are hundreds of miles away. You talk a lot about the media. It's been really interesting for me to look at some of the coverage that's been happening around the investors that are circling PG&E right now. They're saying, oh, we'll take it over. These venture capitalists like Paul Singer, who has been in bed with the Koch brothers for years, investing in anti-climate sentiments. And we see the same thing with Berkshire Hathaway, which is another major utility company that has been trying to stop distributed solar across the United States, just the type of resiliency we need for California. But there are other options that are on the table right now, and they're in action. San Francisco just put in a bid to municipalize their area so that they could take back the grid, so that they could be in charge of their own destiny. And similarly, San Jose, one of the biggest cities that PG&E provides service to, is saying, actually, you know what we should do? We should create a cooperative utility so that it is beholden to the people of California, and we're taking over PG&E at the statewide level.
Well, as we discussed when we talked about public banks on this show with Trinity Tran a few weeks ago, the word public isn't like, you know, pixie dust. It doesn't automatically make things work in a better way, but public utilities would have certain, you know, criteria about being democratized, about being decentralized, about being equitable. It's not just a goal, in other words, but a way to get there and who is involved in the process.
Absolutely. It's not a silver bullet, but it does provide us this opportunity to have more recourse. And the other thing is we're building this thing from scratch, right? Or not from scratch. There is a history of public ownership in the energy sector, but we have the ability to design into that institution things like decentralization, things like equity, things like a democratized system, and build upon what we've seen work in the past and also where we've seen public utilities historically fail. This is a huge opportunity for California to create an energy system that's rooted in climate justice, that's rooted in the realities of the changing climate and how they're going to ensure that they actually are creating a resilient California.
That was Johanna Bozua speaking with Counterspin in November 2019. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Erica Rosado. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Portland.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I am your host, Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilliland.
Thank you for joining us. Before we jump into our discussion today, just like to give a shout out to a special thanks to the Labor Radio Podcast Network